Welcome to the podcast series from the National Centre for Research Methods at the University of Southampton. In today's podcast, we talk to Professor John Curtis from the University of Strathclyde about key issues and points of interest for the forthcoming election. It followed his talk at a recent event hosted by the National Centre for Research Methods, British Election Study and British Polling Council on predicting and understanding the 2015 general election.
I think the crucial thing to appreciate is that we are probably looking at a general election where the choice put before voters is different from in the past. And certainly the battle between the different political parties is a very different battle from the one usually characterised. We normally say that an election in the UK is won or lost in the centre ground, that whichever party can convince those voters who are neither particularly left-wing nor particularly right-wing, that they are better able to provide the country with effective government, is the party that's going to succeed in winning the election. And that, as a result, indeed, therefore, the contest is essentially a contest between Conservative and Labour for that centre ground. But one of the things that's been happening to British politics, even before this parliament, is that increasingly voters were willing to vote for parties other than Conservative or Labour. And despite the very sharp decline in Liberal Democrat support in this parliament in the wake of their being part of a coalition for the first time since 1945, it's now the case that indeed voters are now willing to vote for other parties to a much greater extent than they have been in the past. Over a quarter of people at the moment are saying, according to the opinion polls, that they might vote for UKIP or the Greens or the Scottish National Party or Plaid Cymru or whatever.
So that presumably makes it a very different looking contest.
If we look at where parties have been losing and gaining votes during this course of Parliament, it's not the case that the Conservative Party, which is now about 5 points or so on average in the opinion polls below where it stood in 2010, it's not lost those votes to the Labour Party. It's not even lost them to the Democrats. It's lost 2/3 of them to UKIP. Meanwhile, we look at the battle for the Labour Party. The Labour Party not been gaining votes to the Conservatives. It's now around 3 or 4, overall, the party's 3 or 4 points higher than it was back in 2010. But what's in the battle for? Well, essentially, it's been profiting primarily from the disaffection of Liberal Democrat voters, who certainly earlier in this parliament, around 1/3 of them switched to Labour, but now may also be engaged in a battle with the Greens to hang on to those voters, because now it looks as though Liberal Democrat voters are showing a particular propensity to switch to the Greens. Meanwhile, in Scotland, we have seen the Labour vote 1/3 or so of people saying, I voted Labour in 2010, but I'm now going to vote for the Scottish National Party. Now, what you then therefore need to realise is, therefore, the Conservatives' principal target is to try to get votes from UKIP, which voters are for the most part to the right of the Conservative Party. The Labour Party is engaged in a battle to regain votes from the SNP and to try to ensure it doesn't lose votes to the Greens. Now, in both cases, again, we're talking about parties and bodies of voters that are for the most part to the left of where the Labour Party currently stands. And therefore, as a result, Conservative and Labour are actually not necessarily engaged in a battle with each other for the centre ground, but rather a battle with parties to the left and to the right of them for which party can appeal to the ideological preferences and kinds of society that voters are looking for. So that does make this contest a very different one. And the fact that, of course, there are now more political parties fighting means that there are more things that the opinion pollsters have to try to get right and they have to estimate. So far as the opinion pollsters are concerned, it also becomes a rather more demanding election. So different for parties and also more of a challenge for pollsters.
So I wonder, if, from your perspective as a researcher and from a methods perspective, if you like, when you're trying to unpick all of this information, where are you turning to for your information, and what are the key considerations here?
Well, I mean, there is no doubt that, of course, what all of us are looking at and all of us are guided by in our assessment of what's been happening, where which party is up and which is down, and where they've been gaining votes to and from, we look at the opinion polls together with the results of academic surveys such as the British Election Study. And our understanding are really founded on them. Now, for example, at the moment, certainly, so far as trying to see whether or not parties are winning or losing ground, we're not just looking at the share of the vote, for example, but we're also looking where votes have come from and are going to. So the understanding that the Conservatives are in a battle with UKIP and Labour, for example, in a battle for the SNP, is based on the fact that opinion polls don't only tell us what people say they're going to do now, but they also ask them what they did back in 2010. And that therefore gives us some pretty good idea as to what the shifts are. So our understanding of the flows and ebbs of politics rely on that. But then what's also true, of course, is that no opinion poll these days, however well conducted, simply says, oh, well, we found that 30% of our people said they were going to vote Conservative, 32% Labour, 5% Liberal Democrat or whatever. The truth is that all opinion pollsters, and this has certainly been true ever since the polling debacle of 1992, are aware that it's actually very difficult to get samples of the population in a relatively short period of time that we are absolutely sure are representative.
So what sorts of strategies might the various companies employ to overcome these difficulties?
All pollsters, for example, say, well, hang on, I know I should have so many men, so many women, so many younger people, so many older people, etc. So I need to make sure that if I don't have enough, for example, younger people, that I weight my samples so that the younger people I've got count more to the totals that I'm contributing to. That's designed to try and overcome the dangers that younger people who are, for example, more likely to vote Green, less likely to vote UKIP, more likely to vote Labour, less likely to vote Conservatives, are not underrepresented in the samples. So we're looking to see at that and what impact that is having on the estimates the polling companies are coming up with. And you can see some patterns. I mean, one thing, for example, is that actually for some companies, this weighting has a pretty big influence on their estimate of how well UKIP are doing. In particular, YouGov and Populus, who are both doing their polls online, and for the most part, online pollsters are getting a higher share of the vote for UKIP than those polls are done by telephone. But Populus and YouGov are an exception to that rule. But then actually, when you look at their weighting strategies, you discover actually their weighting, in particular, the way they weight by the what people say their longer-term loyalties are, is reducing the UKIP share in those polls estimates. So one needs to be aware, therefore, that the weighting that the pollsters have engaged in are important, and people like me spend quite a lot of time trying to understand what's going on there in order to come to an assessment of, well, actually, you know, do I necessarily believe this opinion poll? Do I think the weighting strategy that's being engaged in is robust or not? Are we actually clear that when a pollster is weighting to some target figure or other, that actually we are clear that that target figure is necessarily correct?
And what about this whole question of actually getting people to commit to say who it is they will be voting for?
Some of the people who say they voted for a particular party last time are more likely to say, no, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do, or I don't know what I'm going to do, than the supporters of other parties. Back in 1992, we learned that Conservative supporters seemed to be rather less willing to say what they were going to do, and the pollsters, by failing to take that into account, was one of the reasons why they underestimated Conservative support. At the moment, indeed, again, we tend to find that Conservative supporters and certainly Liberal Democrat supporters are rather more likely to say they don't know what they're going to do. In the case of Liberal Democrats, almost undoubtedly a genuine uncertainty. These are people who are probably disenchanted with the Liberal Democrats back in office, but haven't quite convinced themselves they should vote for somebody else. And some of the pollsters, not all of them, are saying, well, hang on, I suspect that quite a lot of these folk are going to end up voting Conservative or Liberal Democrat or whatever, and they adjust their polling estimates in order to take that into account. So again, so therefore, there's another important consideration. And for example, ICM consistently come up with higher estimates of how well the Democrats are doing than do most other companies. Why? Because they in particular make quite a big adjustment for the fact that Liberal Democrat vote, people who voted Liberal Democrat in 2010 are rather reluctant to say what they're going to do at the moment. Now, whether they're right or whether they're wrong in that adjustment, in truth, we'll only find out after May the 7th. But certainly, therefore, one needs to be aware that this is the reason why ICM are getting more Liberal Democrat supporters in their headline vote totals than are some of the other companies.
I'm keen to ask you a couple more general questions about your thoughts about the forthcoming general election. This whole question of public support for politics and voter apathy, this week the church weighing in and trying to encourage more engagement. I wonder what your take is on this.
My understanding of what the Church of England was trying to say is I think, something that perhaps fits into the wider story that we were talking about earlier, about, you know, how this is now an election where there are far more parties at stake. One of the things the Church was, I think, trying to say was, look, Actually, if you're going to get people interested and excited and enthused about politics, you need to present them with a picture, the kind of country you're trying to create, the kind of society you want. And now, some people accuse the church of having a particular view of what kind of society it wanted, but let's leave that to one side. There was a message there, which is, hang on, you need to tell voters what you are trying to achieve. Now, it's what kind of spin doctors sometimes call having a narrative. And I think I would certainly argue that at the moment, one of the reasons why actually Conservative and Labour and Liberal Democrat are all struggling to command the attention of the public and the support of the public and are proving vulnerable to UKIP on the right, the SNP and the Greens on the left, is that they all of them failing to articulate and are struggling to articulate their vision of the future. I mean, for example, we all know that David Cameron used to talk about the big society. There was constant commentary about, hang on, we're not quite sure what you mean, Mr. Cameron. And he seems to have given up on trying to explain to us. Mr. Miliband has long been criticized for the fact that at one moment it was responsible capitalism, then it was one nation labor, then it was about predators and producers, all about apparently attempts to give an idea of the kind of country he wants. But again, all attempts that he doesn't seem to have been able to drive through and to get people to buy into. In contrast, I think for good or ill, most people know what UKIP want. They want to get out of the European Union. They're not terribly keen on immigrants. Most people know what the SNP in Scotland want. They would like Scotland to be an independent country. And in the meantime, they would like it to have more powers. And they also want to make the country more social democratic as they see it. Everybody know the Greens have a particular concern about the environment, and they're also very reluctant to buy into the existing economic model that says there should be austerity. So I think, you know, there is a crucial point here. There's a crucial challenge to our kind of conventional Westminster parties, that one of the reasons perhaps why they're losing ground is that, you know, there are parties out there that are laying out very different visions, and in laying out very different visions are succeeding in getting enthusiasm, interest of the public.
So what does all that mean for the prospects for voter turnout? What does the research evidence tell us here?
If the polls say it's going to be close, more people say, well, you know what, actually it might be worth the shoe leather, making it to the polling station and turning out to vote. So if it continues to look like an exciting election, that should help to drive the turnout up. The second very particular thing north of the border is that it seems to be pretty clear that the referendum, which of course had a very high turnout of 85%, has left a legacy of people being interested in politics, being concerned about the issues that confront Scotland in particular. And the polling evidence certainly is, it looks as though the turnout in Scotland might again be, relative to the rest of the UK, relatively high. So I'm not sure, despite all the cynicism out there, despite perhaps the difficulty of a number of parties to articulate a vision of what they're in favour of, I suspect that we will end up with a higher turnout, and particularly we'll end up with a higher turnout than the rather low turnouts we've had in recent elections north of the border.
I'd just like to ask you a little bit more about UKIP. I mean, obviously there's been considerable speculation about the impact they're having as the campaign is unfolding and on any possible outcome. What's your thinking there?
There's some very clear facts, and then there's kind of rather broader bound of speculation. The very clear facts are that if you look at the polling evidence as to what UKIP voters say they did back in 2010, what you discover is that those people who said they voted Conservative have been consistently more likely than those who say they voted Liberal Democrat or Labour to now be saying they're going to vote for UKIP. Now, it's not that UKIP only get votes from people who are Conservatives. That's certainly not true. They also gain votes from people who said they voted Labour and Liberal Democrat in 2010. But it's also clear that they are disproportionately gaining ground from the Conservatives. And that therefore, other things being equal, in those constituencies where the Conservatives are defending a tight margin against a Labour or Liberal Democrat challenge, or indeed in constituencies that perhaps they're hoping to pick up from Labour or the Liberal Democrats, where they're not it's a kind of 50-50 contest. Other things being equal, the better that UKIP do, the more difficult it is going to be for the Conservatives to pick up those seats. Not clear that UKIP are going to pick up a lot of seats from the Conservatives, although in truth this is one of the big uncertainties of the election as to exactly where UKIP will do well. I mean, for example, only earlier this week, Lord Ashcroft published yet further of his polls looking in particular at constituencies where UKIP are doing well, were challenging the Conservatives. And in each case, UKIP are just behind the Conservatives. They might just lose out. And you know, that could happen in quite a lot of places. But if they do slightly better, they'll start picking up seats. But the real difficulty for the Tories is probably not so much seats they lose to UKIP, but seats they don't gain from Labour or Democrats that they should have done.
And what about when it comes to trying to work out who these UKIP voters are, where they're coming from? How do you unpick all of that?
People look at the UKIP vote and they say, well, this is an incredibly working class vote. You know, hang on, how is it these people are ex-Tory voters disproportionately? You know, well, are they perhaps people who voted Labour in 2001 or 2005, but have already become disaffected with Labour? Now, some people try to do that, but it's very difficult to get robust evidence that far back. But certainly, I think what one could ask oneself is, well, hang on, if it were true, if we look at the past, for example, when the Liberal Democrats were not in government, then we usually said, well, when people are unhappy with the Tories in government, they use the Liberal Democrats as a vehicle of protest. Well, the vehicle of protest was no longer available. Are these, therefore, people that the Liberal Democrats might otherwise have hoped to pick up, but have now gone to UKIP because they're, what's available is the vehicle of protest? And equally, certainly, one could ask oneself, well, hang on, you know, if the Conservatives are in trouble, given these are folk who are relatively working class, why aren't Labour able to appeal them? If they were regarded as a more effective opposition and there was greater enthusiasm about the prospect of Labour government, would some of these people be voting for Labour, perhaps even despite their views about immigration that many of them hold? Now, those are much more speculative questions. They're very valid questions. So short answer to you is, it's the Conservatives who probably have most to worry about UKIP.
You've talked a bit about the Scottish referendum. I know you were very actively involved and watched that very, very carefully. But what impact would you say it's had on the political landscape? And does it help us understand what might happen in the general election, do you think?
The referendum in Scotland has changed the rules of the game for electoral competition for Westminster. And it seems to have had a fundamental impact. Now, one of the things that we have long been witnessing in Scotland, ever since the advent of devolution back in 1999, was that voters in Scotland were tending to say, I'm going to vote differently in the two elections. So it's been the case that in Westminster elections in Scotland, since the advent of devolution, the Labour Party has continued to be the largest party. And even in 2010, when the Labour Party in England and Wales was recording one of its worst results in its history, the party actually gained ground slightly, and continued to command the attention of the Scottish public with 42% of the vote and 41 out of 59 seats. From the very beginning, people seemed to be rather more willing to vote for the Scottish National Party in elections to the devolved Scottish Parliament, such that indeed by 2007, the SNP very narrowly came ahead and, of course, in 2011, achieved that now very famous overall majority, which indeed paved the way to the referendum. And now, one of the things that we also knew behind that was that people were in Scotland were asking themselves a different question at a Westminster election from a Scotland election. They were saying to themselves in the Westminster election, OK, which party is going to be best for Britain? Oh, well, that's the Labour Party. The SNP don't really have much chance of having much influence at Westminster. The Scottish election, which party is best for Scotland, was the question the majority were asking themselves. And for that, Scotland's the SNP. This is the party that most manifestly stands up for Scotland's interests. I'll vote for that. What seems to have happened in the wake of the referendum, a referendum in which the people of Scotland spent 2 years arguing about the future of Scotland, and what was going on in the rest of the UK was to some degree a sideshow, is that it means that at least for half the population, particularly that half of the population that voted yes, it's the future of Scotland upon which they are still focused. They're also wanting to say, look, I really do back independence, and therefore, as a result, first of all, about 85% of those people who say they voted yes in the referendum are saying they're going to vote for the SNP. And that secondly, the difference between how people say they would vote in a Westminster election and that in a Scottish Parliament election has now, it's not entirely disappeared, but it's almost disappeared. And therefore, as a result, what we're looking at essentially at the SNP at around 45% in the opinion polls, which is what they got in the referendum in September, and is, by the way, what they got in May 2011. Now, in a PPR election such as the Scottish Parliament election of May 2011, that just got them an overall majority. In the referendum, you lose on 45%, but in a first past the post election, when the unionist vote in Scotland is divided between Labour and the Conservatives, and given that the SNP votes very geographically evenly spread, you can potentially pretty much mop up virtually every seat in Scotland. So crucial thing to appreciate. I mean, the Scottish National Party is not going to outpoll UKIP across the UK as a whole if the current polls are correct. It may well indeed not outpoll the Greens if the Greens can hang on to their current level of support. They may even still be quite somewhat behind the Democrats. But in terms of seats, because this is a party doing well in a particular part of the UK, they could well easily emerge with somewhere between 40 and 50 seats and emerge as the third largest party at Westminster. So the referendum has fundamentally changed the way in which voters have been thinking about politics. That's had implications for the way in which they look likely to vote at Westminster, and it could end up having a pretty fundamental impact on the character of the next House of Commons, certainly if we end up with a hung parliament, and in a hung parliament in which perhaps the nationalists have a fair degree of parliamentary leverage.
Just finally, John, it's been said that this is going to be one of the most difficult elections to call. Do you share that view?
If the opinion polls are correct, and some of us remember that the last time the opinion polls told us it was going to be a close race back in 1992, it proved not to be such a close race after all. But if the opinion polls are correct, and indeed it's close between Conservative and Labour, then bearing in mind that relatively small shifts in parties' votes can make quite a big difference to the kind of hung parliament you've got and which parties can arithmetically do deals with another party. The truth is, yes, this is going to be a pretty tough election to call. There's no guarantee that every pollster is going to get it right in terms of who's going to get the most votes. And certainly we remain very unsure, two or three months out, as to exactly the kind of parliament we're going to get. I think the one thing we are kind of saying to ourselves as well, yes, we could just about see perhaps one party getting over a majority, more likely Labour than Conservatives. But the truth is, at the moment, at least, we look as though we're in hung parliament territory. We've been in that territory for quite a while. And so therefore, calling this election does undoubtedly become much more difficult, if indeed that picture is correct.
Professor John Curtis was talking about predicting and understanding the 2015 general election. You can find out more about the event that he was speaking at on the NCRM website at www.ncrm.ac.uk.